Phil, good afternoon, everyone. I'm glad there's an everyone. We sitting here talking with Brad and Arlene until about quarter after, and it was just the three of us here. And Brad was wondering out loud if it would just be the three of us, and now we got a good crowd, so it's wonderful. And we knew certain people would be out of town. Shelby's still battling this plantar fasciitis, and although it's just coming, she wanted to come. But just coming to church wouldn't be a big deal to come here and walk in, walk out, but we have the grandchildren, Tara's serving at a camp, and she's already left. So we have the grandchildren, and chasing them around and getting them ready and doing all that. I just said, you know, you need to stay off your foot today. So I encouraged her to stay home, and she did. But she misses being here and says hi. Well, today I want to talk about love stories. Now, for some of us, most of us in here are of a certain age, we can remember a movie called Love Story. But I hope that today you'll be willing to share a little bit of your love stories, your particular love stories. I will share some, even though my wife isn't here, but she's heard me say some of these things in public before, and she's okay with it. We'll talk about a little bit about the expectations that participants in a love story have for each other. And I hope that you'll share some of that you experienced in your own story. Then we'll go to the Bible, and we'll look at another love story, one with a connection to this time of year, but maybe not the one you might think that I'd be turning to. And finally, we will examine in more detail one particular aspect of all of these love stories. And if you want a title, the title of the sermon is Love Story. So first, what I'd like to do, and this is where I invite your participation, I hope, is get some information from you about your own particular love stories and how it all works. And I would suggest, and this could be organized in a different way, but I would suggest that the first thing that has to happen is an introduction of some sort. Is that fair to say? Yeah, you have to meet each other first in order for there to be any kind of a relationship. I've got something I can share, but I'll give you a chance first. Anybody want to share your, it doesn't matter how this all turns out, I just want to find out some interesting stories here. Anybody want to share how you met? Any neat stories about that? Some of you that are couples? Okay, here we go. Thank you. You always knew each other. Okay, that's interesting. Yeah, so it didn't require an introduction. Okay, go ahead, Sandy.
Well, that was interesting. I was never that forward type of person, but we were roller skating, and we didn't know each other. And it was ladies' choice couple. So after a couple of girlfriends kept egging me on to find somebody to get out here to skate with, I looked around, didn't see anybody out there in the floor skating that I was interested in wanting to get to know, and I didn't think. And I looked back into the pool room, and there he is. I said, except him. He's nice looking. And then, but he was busy. And I said, yeah, he has probably brothers or something, or two young kids with him back playing pool. And he said, well, come back anyway. And then he said, no. So finally, before the skate ended, I decided, okay, I guess I will. So I go back there, and I'm like, hello. And he turns around, looks at me, and I said, ladies' choice couple, would you like to skate? And he looks at me, and he goes, sure. Well, you should have heard his two brothers. Oh, no, Ray, you promised you'd play pool. Well, he said, well, I'll be back in a minute. And so that's how we met. We went out skating and got to talk and know each other a little bit. And then the next time there was a break again for couple skate. This time it was just a regular couple skate. And I'm standing there with my friends, and they're like, do you think he'll come back and ask you again? Did you like him and all that? And I'm like, yeah, he was really nice. I hope so. But if he don't, I'm not going to find him. Well, sure enough, he comes around and comes skating up to me and says, want to go out again? And that was the start of our relationship.
Ah. Can you play pool on skates?
Yeah.
Okay. I can't. I'm a terrible roller skater.
At one time, I was pretty good at it.
I think if I would hit a, if I would try to strike a ball, I'd end up going the other way or something. It wouldn't happen.
Try playing jet hockey yet while you have ice skating.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
I do that too.
Any other stories you want to share? It's interesting. You have to somehow get to know each other. I'll share mine, and Shelby, you know, she's not here to defend herself. You can talk to her later. But we were at some youth activity in Hershey. You know, we're both from Maryland, so we're up in Pennsylvania, and I can remember being up in some kind of bleachers. I don't remember exactly what the arrangement was. I don't remember where we were. And I saw this young lady that I didn't know, and I'm not terribly forward, but I tend to be more forward than you. I'll go up, say hi to somebody, and try to start a conversation. So Shelby didn't go to, you know, we were both in a church, obviously, we're at this church activity, but I was in Baltimore, she went to Hagerstown, and even though we didn't live terribly far apart, the line separating the churches was in between us, and I didn't know her at all. But I saw that this young lady had a letter jacket on from a school in my county. So I thought, that's a good, you know, get a way to start a conversation. And I walked up to her, said hi, and said, I was probably in college. I don't know if she was in high school or not. I don't remember. But you go to Francis Scott Key. That's the name of the school, high school she went to. So you go to Francis Scott Key. You know, I go to South Carolina. She says, that's what it says. That was our introduction. That's what it says. It didn't get much better for a while. Anyway, anybody else want to share before we move on? You got to have an introduction first. You got to meet each other. And that was my introduction with Shelby. And we didn't have another contact probably for another year. And maybe no reason to. I don't know. But once you meet somebody and you kind of like them a little bit, then what's the next phase as the relationship develops? What would you call that?
Like dating.
Dating, courtship. You know, you're kind of interested in this person and you think maybe you might want to marry him. So it's the getting to know you part of the relationship. I don't like that song, by the way, because I got in trouble in 10th grade, I think it was. Girl in front of me was a cheerleader, and the girl behind me was buying cookies or something, and I passed something between. And the teacher purposely tried to embarrass me. She started singing, getting to know you, getting to know all about you. I was like, oh. Anyway. That has nothing to do with the subject here. But getting to know you is the next phase. You want to begin developing a relationship, maybe, and you got to find out about the other person to see if it's really what you want, right? So that phase carries on. Let's say this would go, you know, it goes on for a while. Anybody want to share any courtship stories? I know one person in here who has one because he's told it before, but I can share you. I might share a couple. But anybody have during that period of time where you start getting to know each other? Anybody want to share anything there? It doesn't have to be funny. It could just be interesting or whatever. With Shelby and I, we had a very, very, we had a 3-year chase. I was after her when I finally, it all started at a feast. I had gone up early to a festival. Good friends of mine were there. And I went up, there was a Sabbath service before the feast in the Poconos, and I was there at the administration building where they were having a service, and my friends were there, and I was talking to them and said, why don't you come over to the house? They had a big house. Why don't you come over to our house after church? And, you know, we'll have a meal and whatever. The feast hadn't started yet. I said, sure, I'll come over. I went over there, and Shelby and her brothers and her mother were all staying at this house as well. So I got to see her again. And then because of that, you know, being interested in her somewhat already, I kind of got I was bitten right away. And during the feast, there was a couple that wanted to have that we knew that wanted a bunch of us to come over and play cards. And Shelby didn't want to go. And one of my friends, his whole family, there was a whole bunch of kids. And the oldest one basically wrestled, whatever he would have called it, with Shelby, and wouldn't let her go until she said yes, she would go with her, play cards. So that's how I got my first date with my wife, is a friend of mine wrestled her until she said yes, because he wouldn't let her go. So that's not a real encouraging start, but it worked. And I didn't put him up to it. It wasn't like she was dating, going with me, because we were all, it was three or four of us that were going. But he wouldn't let her go till she said yes. And that was the first time we ever spent any time together. And I chased her for off and on for 3 years. And we had a really rocky courtship. It was up and down and off and on. And finally, up near where we live now, up near Gettysburg, she wanted me to come to this, go to a nice place, have a nice meal, and she wanted to talk. And basically, it was the Dear John, instead of a letter, she told me face to face in a nice way, like, you need to get on with your life. It's not going to be with me. You know, she didn't say it like that, but that's what she said. And we had kind of some of that stuff before, but I never really let go. I would always kind of like just wait a few weeks and and this time I thought, no, maybe it's really over. Maybe I really need to let go. And I started enjoying life without her. And the best thing in the world happened. She started chasing me right away, almost right away, because I was, I'd go out with somebody else and actually appear to be having a good time. And she chased me, and that was much better. So that's the way our courtship went. It was a rocky 2 or 3 years, and ending up with her chasing me, which was much more to be preferred to the original. Anybody else want to share anything that in your courtship phase? Come on, Ron. I know you want to. Oh, you're going to say, you're going to tell it. Okay.
He always told me that he saw my youngest daughter first and fell in love with her first.
Oh.
And if I wanted her, I'd marry her.
That's the way it worked. How about the time, you going to tell us about the time you drove up to see her? Or down, or where? I don't know where you were. You told us that story before.
Oh, the first time he came to visit me.
I think it was the first time.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, I was painting in my kitchen, and I was a mess. And knocking the door, and I opened up the door, and there he stood. I said, "You dirty dog," and closed the door.
But he's persistent. He came back. That's good. That's good.
But I graciously then opened up the door and invited him in.
That would be discouraging. Okay. Anybody else want to share anything? Something. Go ahead, Arlene.
Brad was very shy. And I was kind of also very shy. We worked at the same place, Reese Hoffman and Carlisle. And we knew each other as good fellow employees for about 10 years. And then he left and went to a competitor to work after, I guess, you lost your job, right? Feel free to chime in when you're done. So here he comes back after a few years, and he's in the electronics department repairing their machines and so forth. And I asked someone who would be good to repair a radio. And they said, "Well, Brad Faisal does everybody's repair work around here." And I said, "Okay." So I came over to Brad one day and I said, "Brad, I understand you're the Mr. Fix-It for this department." He goes, "I don't like to be called Mr. Fix-It." He looked over his glasses. "I want to be known for me, who I am." "Now, this sounds like somebody wants to have a friend here."
Okay. Wow.
So I'm working on the other side, so I make it a point every day to stop by and talk to Brad. And what we talked about was religion. I was Jehovah's Witness. He was what we all are.
Uh-huh.
And I said, "I don't think we're that different. We believe almost the same thing." So I don't know where it went from there. Do you? Something about getting I got a pat on the wrist before Christmas vacation. I know Brad just took a little pat and gave me there before we went on 2-week vacation. And then after that, I came back to work after the 2 weeks, and I had bought a radio for in my old 55 Ford that my dad and I had done over and painted. And I guess this was later on about July. It was one of the hottest days in the summer that year. Here he is out there upside down under my dash, putting my radio in my car.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess from that time on, we just kept getting closer and closer. So he didn't think I was available. I had someone else that I was seeing and had for many years, and I was just like hanging on to him because I didn't think anybody would want an old lady like me. And I was 40 years old. So, and he's 8 years younger, of course. So, one day, I guess you invited me out to dinner, didn't you? He invited me down at Glen Miller's Riverboat. I don't know if anybody knows that place or not, but that was a nice place to eat. So we went down there, and at that time I was smoking. And he said, "Well, I don't want you to smoke anymore." I said, "Okay." So right then and there, I gave it up.
You must have liked him.
And then we had our second date. I think it was at the York Steakhouse at the mall. Long story short, we closed up the place. We sat there for hours and hours and hours.
Mm-hmm.
So the place closed. And I had never had any fellow anyway listen to me about my life story, because I had been married, had a son and everything, and here he is, the young man, never had a marriage or anything. So that was it.
Yeah. The rest is history, yeah. So we have a courtship. We've all had our stories. And you get to know each other, and finally you decide, you know, this is the guy or this is the girl. And what's the next step?
Planning.
Hmm?
Planning your life.
Okay, but you have to.
After your courtship, you start.
You have to
discuss
what's our in our tradition. The next step is
married.
The you know engaged. You got to ask, right? You got to ask. You got to ask and become engaged. And there might be some stories there. I don't know. We got anybody want to share an engagement story? How you did it? How it worked? Or okay, here we go. You knew each other forever, so now what happened?
well, we started dating. That was a whole other story. But when we got engaged, he took me over to his parents were gone, but we went over to his parents' house and he cooked the spaghetti dinner with candlelight and wine, really nice. And then we went out. We were sitting on the porch swing. I didn't know he was going to propose to me. You know, I had no clue. And I think he was getting close to proposing, and his nephew drove up and started talking like there was some problem at the shop. He had to talk about it. So instead of just talking to him, he's like, "Hey, let's go over here and talk." And they went off the porch and around the side of the house, and I was thinking, is your business top secret? Like, countertop? Like, what's going on? But then he got his nephew to go away, and then came back and proposed.
Ah, that's a neat story. Neat, yeah. Anybody else want to share one? I want to say that, you know, we have a tradition also in our society that we ask the father of the bride first. And I always got along with the man that became my father-in-law. He's a nice man. And but I was a little you're always nervous. If you're the guy, you're nervous about that. I did it. I asked him, if I could marry his daughter. And you get an A in the course here if you can guess what he said. If I haven't told you before. He said, "What's her mother say?" Now that was a red flag. I should have paid attention to that. But anyway, what's her mother say? Okay, I guess he agreed. And then when I planned, I had all this planned out. I had this Oldsmobile Cutlass. It had white leather interior, and it had bucket seats that went out. They went like this so you could get out because he kind of sat down low, the way the Cutlass was back then. And we were going to go down to Folger's Theater in Washington and see The Rivals, which is a neat play where everybody's pretending to be somebody else, and it gets all complicated. And you've heard the term malaprop or malapropism for a wrong word. It kind of sounds right, but it's the wrong word. That comes from that play, because there was a Mrs. Malaprop that was always using almost the right word, but not quite, for comedic effect. And that was also foresight married into that, too. But anyway, we had this all planned out. I was going to propose in a restaurant in Frederick before we went down to Washington. My parents were aware of this. I think her parents were. I knew, of course, and she didn't. And she said something the day before or 2 days before about smelling something in my car. Well, it turns out my nice Cutlass had a radiator leak. And it's like, I can't go all the way down to Washington in this. So I call my dad, and he would drive this old Valiant to work. It was my grandmother's car. And it wouldn't heat up. This is January. You could never get enough heat out of it. And anyway, that's what we went down with, this night that I'm going to propose to Shelby. We're in the old Valiant. Luckily, we had a blanket in there so you could be warm. And I had the ring already from her mother. Mother had a ring that had gone back in the family a little bit, so I had the ring. Everything was all ready. And we're in the Sheraton. It's a Holiday Inn now, but it had some seats that were booths that were raised up from the others. It was kind of nice and somewhat romantic, maybe. And this is before we're going down to Washington. And I don't remember how I said it, but I had it all prepared. And it's like, would you marry me? You also get an A if you can guess what she said. And it wasn't ask my mother, but she didn't say no. She said, I guess so. I guess so. I didn't know how to take that for sure. I said, yes or no? Anyway, anybody else want to share any other engagement stories? Yeah, Dan.
My wife asked me to get, I didn't ask her.
She asked you. Oh, there you go. Okay. And you said yes, I suppose.
I did, yes.
Okay, good, good. Good. All right. Now, we're up to the point now where we're engaged. That's our culture here. Now, my wife had actually been engaged before and broken it off. And that's something, I didn't mention this when I've done this before, but that's something in our culture, an engagement is something that can be broken off relatively easy. Like, it's like, oh, no, we're having second thoughts about this. This isn't a good idea. Give the ring back and everything's, you're back to square one, right? That's okay. Historically, it wasn't always that way. Engagements were a real thing, for a real thing with a contract. And we'll talk more about that later. But once you're at that phase, once you said yes, once Dan said yes to his wife, once Tammy said yes to Phil, once Shelby said yes to me, once you have this expectation and this new phase of your life, and here's where I want to slow down a little bit and use the board. And I brought that thing. I didn't realize I was going to have this. So we can have lots of input here. I got a lot of room here to say. But once you get to that point and you've said, I do, does that come with any expectations? That's a yes or a no question, right? Are there expectations with that? Yeah. We expect something. Whether you're the man or the woman in this relationship, there are certain expectations because there's been a yes, I will marry you. And that's what I'd like to do. I'd like to write some of these down, if you would give them to me. What kind of expectations do we have when we get to that point? And from now on, this, or, as opposed to the way it was a year ago, you're going to be this way now, or whatever. What kind of expectations do we have for each other?
Commitment to each other and no more dating and seeing anyone else.
Okay. Nobody else. That's a big one, obviously. And commitment. That's the first thing that comes to my mind. Nobody else. There might have been others, but not anymore. Okay. What else? What else are we tend to expect? And it could be things that are related to this. Anything else come to mind? Even if you're not married, you can participate in this. What do you think when you get engaged you're going to expect of the man or the woman that you are engaged to? No, nothing else comes to mind? Did anything change in your life once you were engaged? Go ahead.
To me, and this may happen over a period of time, not necessarily immediately on the I do or I yes, but I think over that period of time until the actual marriage is there is a general combining of efforts and resources towards that end until, I know in some societies, and I know with my wife and I, because she was from Germany, we were constantly looking at how are we going to move our resources together, because she had a dowry and I, we had utilized that for certain purposes. So there was certain resources that we had to combine.
Okay. Combine resources. Plan. Mm-hmm. All right. Anybody else? If you're not, I don't think you. Maybe we've got to think a little more imaginatively. Well, in your case, I don't know how it was. I know how it was in mine. But did you have to start doing some different things? For instance, once you were engaged to her, once you were engaged to him, did you have to do certain things with him or her that maybe you wouldn't have done before? Like, what did you do on Father's Day or Mother's Day or Thanksgiving or, you know, on and on?
Well, I was going to say, you'd have to meet the in-laws if you haven't, but you'd be combining activities.
Yeah.
Okay.
So you're combining activity or, you know, how would I put it? I'll put it this way. Let's say one of you said, respect my family. Let's put it that way.
Keeping the in-laws happy.
You're marrying my family too. Yeah. Okay. When it comes to nobody else, now this may be just a subset of that in a way, but if you're a girl or a woman, or could it go either way, what has to disappear from here? Besides the money that always disappears. What else has to disappear from this? Well, no, yeah, that's if they're a woman, but
other phone numbers.
Okay. Yeah, all right.
A little black book.
No pictures, right? The pictures.
Oh, okay.
And the phone numbers. I didn't think of that. I had a guy that worked for me that he's married and two kids, happily, you know, so forth. But he had been engaged, and he actually called the wedding off the week, I think it was a week before. It was a good thing. It wouldn't have worked with the other woman. But even while he was dating that other woman, he had a picture in his wallet. I knew that. We knew this because he worked for us. He had his picture in his wallet of somebody that he really, really liked a long time ago, and broke his heart when she broke up with him. No, you got to get rid of that picture, though, right? Because that's part of this, like nobody else. Yeah, we do things together. You got to join the family activities. It's maybe two different things. You say family activities. I think somebody said something like that. Combined activities. Activities. So, but also, I would say respect my family. You know, you have two fathers or two mothers if everybody's still alive, right? You have to show respect not just to your dad, but also my dad and my mom and so forth. So, a little bit different there. You got to kind of not just respect them, maybe like them.
Hopefully, pretend to like them.
Yeah, whatever. We hope you like them. Yeah, yeah, it works both ways, doesn't it? Yeah. Anything else come to mind?
Like their children, if they have any.
Hmm?
Like their children, get along with the children.
Oh, if they're children, yeah, that would be, yeah. Yeah, same thing with, I didn't think about that, but yeah. Family either way.
That's a problem.
That's I can definitely, uh-huh. Church.
Religion.
gave this as a youth study one time in parts, and one of the first comments was that we need to compromise. I'm thinking, do you really going to compromise on everything? Well, I'm going to compromise on this, and you know, they realize, no, you don't. But there is a certain amount of compromise, I guess. Yes?
And I think that is the most important, to believe, have the same beliefs.
Have the same beliefs. So we'll start after that.
I know from experience.
Okay. Now, maybe some of these, again, are related, but under the nobody else and no pictures, and I didn't bring my, you got to pretend to have sunglasses here. I didn't bring my sunglasses. Okay, here you go. All right, I'm walking on the boardwalk in Ocean City. I got these glasses on. Now, what does my wife expect of me at this point?
Blinders.
Yeah, no looking. What else do we expect of each other? How about in our communication?
Talk to each other.
Hmm? Okay, that's planning. What kind of communication? How does our communication have to be, though? What do we expect from each other? Is there a certain amount of pretense involved in the introduction and in the dating? We try to be somebody that maybe we're not a little bit, just to impress, and then you're engaged. Are we still okay with pretense? Pansy says no. So what do we expect in our communication?
Open.
Open, honesty.
Honest.
Anything else come to mind? Okay, so that's kind of commitment. Accept the whole package, whatever. Okay.
Yeah, accept each other's shortcomings. Or,
right. Or, we're not perfect.
Work through each other's temperaments.
Hmm?
Working through each other's temperaments.
Yeah, okay. How about another thing in our communication? Maybe you wouldn't think of this, because when we're in the pretense phase, if we were, to a certain extent we all, you know, we try to be on our best behavior. Then once you're engaged, you got her, or you got him. You could tend to, and I think we all do, even especially after we get married, we tend to let down maybe, and we're not careful with what we say. That ever happen? You ever say something you wish you wouldn't have said? Yeah. Okay. So we have to be careful what we say. I think that's now that you got her, doesn't mean you can just let it out. Now sometimes we need to change the way we think. This may not be a big deal for you, it's a big deal for me. When it's more so became apparent after we got married, I can remember the first time she sent away one of my suits, the cleaners that she used. She sent one, a pen that I'd had way longer than I ever knew her, and had been a gift as somebody being in a wedding and so forth. And I wasn't real nice about it, and I was really upset. Like, you can't, my pen, you can find my pen. You can't just send it away like that. In her family, and she wouldn't mind me saying it, her family, everything was common property, you know. It wasn't uncommon for her father to complain about, you know, he'd go to use his razor and would cut his face to shreds because one of the females in the house, which was her, had used it to shave her legs, you know. So it's what's yours is yours, what's yours is mine. What's yours is mine, what's mine is mine. Kind of a, that's the way her house was. My house was very rigidly controlled. I mean, you had your things. Dad had his things. My brother had his things, and so forth. So, depending on your temperament and your history and so forth, I think there has to be a respect for space, a respect for each other's things, a respect, respect my things, respect my space, and so forth. That some people, you think that's crazy, but for some of us, that's important. Don't dare take my Monopoly die that I still have from when I was that big. I still have it somewhere. I don't know where it is, but... I'm only half kidding there. Okay. So you look at this list here, and we could have more. You look at the list and you realize that during the part of the relationship where you are engaged but not yet married, it's a lot like being married, isn't it? It's like being married without the bennies, as the kids say, the benefits. There's certain things you don't have yet. You still got to go home to your place maybe or whatever. But, you know, other than that, it's kind of like being married. You're already married. Now, I have a question. If your fiancé routinely violates many of these points, these expectations, would you give the marriage a second thought maybe? Would you tend to reconsider if your fiancé was just trampling all over this list? If your fiancé occasionally makes a mistake, sticks his foot in his mouth, or, you know, she sends your, well, it wouldn't happen to your cleaners, but, you know, doesn't respect your property, whatever, you know, something happens and you feel bad about it, do you end the relationship because of those kinds of mistakes? No. Okay, so we're in agreement on that. We're in agreement. So the relationship is based on love, respect, and this is some of the ways that we can specifically define some of that love and respect, and, you know, make it more specific than just say, "Oh, I love him," but "Oh, I'm willing to go to his family reunions." You know, that's a big deal for me. Her family is really close. She's got 12. Her mother had 11 siblings. So she had all these cousins. And that was just the ones that were blood relations. There were a lot of other ones that were adopted. She's huge. I go to these reunions. I didn't know who anybody was. And it was hard. You know, I had to have a sheet to keep track of it all. Really, literally. All right. So I told, this is, I'm going to leave this up here because this is specific. Some specific things. Now I want to switch gears. I want to go to Ezekiel chapter 16. Ezekiel chapter 16, starting in verse 1. The Bible uses a lot of analogies. You're aware of that. And here's one in the book of Ezekiel. Ezekiel 16, verse 1 says, "The word of the Lord came to me, saying, Son of man, cause Jerusalem to know her abominations. Thus says the Lord God unto Jerusalem, your birth and nativity in the land of Canaan. Your father was an Amorite, your mother was a Hittite. And for your nativity, in the day you were born, your navel wasn't cut, neither were you washed." You know, you weren't cared for. You were a mess. You weren't swaddled. "No, I pitied you," in verse 5. "You were cast out in the open. And I passed by," it says in verse 6. "I saw you polluted in your own blood, and I said to you, when you're in your blood, live." I said to you, live. God noticed Israel, is the way it reads there. That's the analogy. God noticed Israel. He said, live. And we could go back. We're going to come back to Ezekiel 16 again, if you'd like to mark it. But we could go back to Exodus chapter 2. And this has always been interesting to me. In Exodus 2 and verse 23, it says, "It came to pass in the process of time that the king of Egypt died, and the children of Israel sighed by the reason of the bondage, and they cried, and their cry came up to God by the reason of the bondage." I think it's interesting that it doesn't specify to whom they cried, or if they were even crying to anyone in particular. Verse 24 says, and God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and he looked upon them and had respect. God noticed Israel. But I think it's written that way on purpose because I don't think they knew who they were crying to. They weren't crying to anyone in particular. They were just moaning and griping and complaining how bad it was. Because if you turn to Exodus 3, since we're there, and Moses turns and sees this burning bush, right? What does God do, besides telling him to take his sandals off and so forth? What does God do with Moses? What's the first thing he does? Other than tell him to take his shoes off.
Tells him who he is.
It's in time for an introduction. I am the God of your fathers. I don't think they knew. That's just my personal opinion. It doesn't say here. God had to introduce himself. And later on in the chapter, he introduces himself by name, Yahweh, or however you would say it. He has to introduce himself because that's how it starts. That's how a relationship starts. You have to know whoever it is you're having a relationship with. And God had to introduce himself, I assume because they had forgotten who he was, or at least they didn't remember much. In 1 John chapter 4:19, 1 John 4, go to the New Testament. So I'm going to tie this in. It's not just Israel, but it's us too. 1 John 4 and verse 19. We love him because he first loved us. All right, that's what it said back in Ezekiel. God noticed them. God noticed them. And he said, live, right? And Romans 5 verse 8, you can write that down. You know it says that Christ died for us while we were yet sinners. That was the plan. I'm convinced, personally, that it wasn't plan B either. It was plan A. It was the plan from the beginning. I would suggest that this introduction and who God is and the fact that he wants to have a relationship is a Passover message. It's the message of God choosing a people and saying, I want you. I want to have a relationship with you. I accept you. And I would like you to accept me. To me, that's a Passover message. That fits in with that time of year. Fits in with the theme of Passover. God loved us first. You know, that lamb was slain from the foundation of the world. And that's the introduction. There has to be an introduction before there can be a relationship. Now, if we go back to Ezekiel 16, I'm just going to read one more verse here this time. Verse 7 says, I have caused you to multiply as the bud of the field, and you have increased and waxed great, and you are come to excellent ornaments, and so forth. It's talking about how God nurtured Israel to grow and to blossom in many ways. In Deuteronomy chapter 8, Deuteronomy chapter 8, I'll read verses 2 and 3. So after God introduces himself, then there's a period of getting to know you, right? The Israelites had to get to know God. In Deuteronomy, chapter 8. And I'll just break into the thought here. Verse 2, you shall remember all the way which the Lord your God led you these 40 years in the wilderness to humble you and to prove you, to know what was in your heart, whether you would keep his commandments or no. And he humbled you and allowed you to hunger and fed you with manna, which you didn't know, and neither did your fathers know. So God began to work with them to develop a relationship with Israel. And that has to happen. You know, once there's an introduction, okay, I'm God, I'm Yahweh, I want to have a relationship now, we need to start feeling each other out in a sense. We need to have this courtship that goes on, this finding out about one another. James chapter 4 and verse 8, to bring it in a New Testament context. James 4 and verse 8 says, draw near to God, and he will draw near to you. Now, I don't need to read the rest of that. That's the only point I wanted to make. We, in the relationship, as the relationship begins to flourish, we draw near to one another. That's what we did in our courtships that we were talking about. Even Shelby and I eventually began to draw near each other after we got done fighting each other. You know, it says in the Old Testament that Noah walked with God, that Enoch walked with God. So you start walking with your fiancé. You start spending time together. You start going to her family reunions and trying to sort out the 50, 60, 70 people that are there. You start doing these things. You start learning about one another. Psalm 34, verse 8, I think Hugh mentioned this a couple of weeks ago. No, it's a different scripture. It's a different psalm. Sorry, forget that. But I have that in here too, later. Psalm 34. Oh, taste and see that the Lord is good, and blessed is the man that trusts in him. Taste and see. Again, that's an analogy. But we begin to taste and see. The Israelites literally did. They had manna. They could taste it, you know. But even in a figurative sense, we taste and see. We begin to experience one another. That's what we do in our courtships. That's what we do in our relationship with God. He calls us. He accepts us. He says, I want to have a relationship with you. And then you begin to walk, and you begin to learn a little bit about him, or begin to learn a lot about him. And you begin to decide, this is what I want to do. This is the relationship I want to have. I want to have this for the rest of my life, for eternity. I would suggest that this is an unleavened bread message. Unleavened bread goes for 7 days. The festival does. It's a time, I think, it pictures walking with God. You're accepted. Now you have to begin to learn about him and walk and begin to, as we do, we eat the unleavened bread. You ingest Jesus in a sense, to have his ways as be part of us. So we begin to learn how God operates. And it becomes a part of us. We want to operate that way also. So to me, that's the courtship is kind of, or the getting to know you period is kind of an unleavened bread message. But then we come to the engagement. And in Ezekiel, I told you to go back a couple times. In Ezekiel 16, in verse 8, it says, now when I passed by you and looked upon you, behold, the time was the time of love, and I spread my skirt over you. Excuse me. Spread my skirt over you. Remember the story you might have thought when I said I'm going to turn to the Bible and read a love story that I was going to turn to Ruth. But I didn't. But in that story of Ruth and Boaz, remember she asked him, put your skirt over me, put your garment over me. And that's symbolic of you're going to take responsibility, charge, whatever you want to say. You're going to take care of me. God says he did that with us. He did it with, here it's specifically talking about Israel. I'm expanding the analogy and says he does it with us too. But that's the symbolism there of spreading the skirt over, taking responsibility for, taking ownership of in a sense. That's what God does. I swore unto you and entered into a covenant with you, says the Lord God, and you became mine. And I washed you with water and thoroughly washed you, the blood from you. I anointed you with oil, so I fixed you up, put some, you know, made you look good, smell good, so forth. Clothed you with embroidered work, shod you with badger skins, and girded you about with fine linen, covered you with silk. He begins to make us beautiful. I decked thee with ornaments, put bracelets upon your hands, chain on your neck. It's kind of like an engagement ring. You're mine now. You're mine now. That's what he did with Israel, figuratively. That's what he does with us. And we become gods. It becomes official. Now, if we turn to back to, I don't think I'm going to come back to Ezekiel, so I'm going to go to Exodus chapter 19. And you know this is when they're at the mount, and God speaks to them. Exodus 19. And it's in the third month, it says, in verse 1. So it's around the time of Pentecost. So it's a timely, you know, it's timely for now. All right, they departed here and there, and they camped in the desert of Sinai in the wilderness. Moses went up to God, it says in verse 3. God called him out of the mountain. He says, this is what you should tell the children of Israel. You have seen what I did to the Egyptians and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you unto myself, verse 4. Now, therefore, verse 5, if you will obey my voice indeed and keep my covenant, then you shall be a peculiar treasure unto me above all people, for all the earth is mine. So the whole earth is mine, but you're going to be special. You shall be unto me as a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words which you shall speak unto the children of Israel. Verse 7 says that Moses came and called for the elders of the people and laid before their faces all these words that the Lord commanded him. And the people answered and said, all that the Lord has spoken, we will do. The difference between then and now is that an engagement, and actually, you know, even much more recently in history, an engagement was the time that the contract was, in a sense, signed. And there would be a period of time between the engagement, or the betrothal, whatever you want to call it, and the actual marriage when you'd live together, because it took a while to prepare the living quarters, to prepare the job, to prepare everything to get ready to actually live together. But the deal was sealed at the time of the engagement. And it took a bill of divorcement to end that engagement. Remember that when Joseph found out Mary was pregnant and he knew it wasn't by him, he was going to get a bill of divorcement to divorce. He had to do that. They weren't even together yet, but he would have had to do that because that's how serious the engagement was. It wasn't like now where you just give the ring back and it's a done deal. It's over. It was a little more permanent, a little more complicated then. Now, why does all this matter? Well, I've already showed you that there's an analogy there, but in 2 Corinthians chapter 11 and verse 2, we have it said more specifically, 2 Corinthians 11 and verse 2, where Paul writes, I am jealous over you with godly jealousy, for I have espoused you unto one husband, that I may present you as a chaste virgin to Christ. We're engaged. We understand that. We're engaged. That's the status that we're in now. We've, in a sense, signed the contract. I think it's interesting. I never thought about this before until I was working through these verses. But, you know, it's our tradition in this country, at least it was, I don't know if it still is, where you ask the father of the bride for permission to marry his daughter. Isn't John saying, now here's our expert on John here, John 6:44, you can't come to Christ except through the Father. It still has, we have to have his permission, his invitation even. I'm sure you can expound on that later. You want to expound on it right now?
No.
Okay. I mean, the Father's involved. The Father is involved. Just as it is in our tradition. That's just coincidence. We wouldn't have to do it that way. But that's what we do. But it fits in with the way it works in the Bible too. Ephesians 5, you know the verses there. I'll start in verse 25. But Ephesians talks about this relationship between each of us in marriage and says that it has a greater meaning. And the meaning has to do with Christ and the church. And it's a mystery. It's not something even that we understand completely. But it gives us a taste, I guess, of it. Husbands, verse 25, Ephesians 5. Husbands, love your wives, even as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for it. And we as husbands, we don't think, well, we need to sacrifice our life for our wives, but that's what it says. Anytime I do marriage counseling, that's what I teach, because that's what's in there. Verse 29, for no man ever yet hated his own flesh, but nourished and cherished it, even as the Lord the church, for we are members of his body and of his flesh and of his bones. And for this cause shall a man leave his father and mother and shall be joined unto his wife, and they two shall be one flesh. This is a great mystery, but I speak concerning Christ and the church. So marriage is an analogy, and it's also a training ground. And through that relationship, we learn a lot about our relationship with our Father in heaven and his Son. And that's why I chose this way of putting the sermon together. So we're in an engagement period now. Because Revelation 19, I won't turn there, but it says, you know, the marriage of the bride, the Lamb has come and the bride has made herself ready. The marriage is later. Engagement is now. But the engagement is formal and it's contractual. And it's for real. If we're engaged, is it reasonable to think that there are certain expectations between the parties in the engagement? You've already answered that question. You've given a list of however many things we have here. That is reasonable for human beings to expect of one another when they're in the status of being engaged to one another to be married. Does it make sense that if we're engaged to Jesus, that there are reasonable expectations that both sides should have? That makes sense? I think it makes sense. The Church of God has, over the years, been criticized for having a focus on the law. But a focus on law and love is reasonable, because love isn't just this ethereal pie-in-the-sky feeling. It involves real things, okay? So you look at this list. In this relationship that we have with our Father in heaven and His Son, is this a nobody else apply? We call that what? The first commandment. Right? How about no pictures and no phone numbers? We call that the second commandment. How about be careful what you say? We call that the third commandment. How about going to the family activities? What are you doing right now? I call that the fourth commandment. And maybe we can combine that with some others as well. How about respect my family? Five? Honor your father and mother? Nobody else, it's kind of seven also. Respect my things, my space, maybe that's eight. Honesty, nine. No looking, 10. Isn't that amazing? To me it was amazing. Maybe not surprising, but just like, hey, it makes sense. To treat the commandments as something that's done away and unnecessary, that's like saying an engagement means nothing and we don't have any expectations of each other. We wouldn't say that humanly. Why would we say it on a God level? To me, that doesn't make any sense. The Church of God position, and many others, not just the Church of God, but the position that law and love go together and work together in harmony is consistent with our own experience in marriage. If we didn't have some kinds of expectations, some kind of rules of engagement, you could call that, what would the relationship be based on? It's a relationship. It's about a relationship. But we would say humanly there have to be boundaries in this relationship. It can't be four of us. It's only, you know, if you're a woman, it's only one of us. Or if you're a man, it's only one of us. You know, it just makes sense. 1 Corinthians chapter 2 and verse 9. I said before that being engaged, humanly speaking, is kind of like being married without the bennies, without the benefits. Because the expectations are there, but the reality is not there yet. And sure enough, that applies to 1 Corinthians chapter 2 and verse 9. It is written, "Eye has not seen, nor ear heard, nor neither entered into the heart of man the things that God has prepared for them that love him." So we're in this relationship, we have these expectations, but the reality isn't here yet, and we can't even imagine it. Not, I mean, we could try, but we're in this frame, we're in this physical frame, and we can't imagine it because it's beyond that. 1 John chapter 3 and verse 2 says the same thing in different words. 1 John 3 and verse 2, "Beloved, now we are the sons of God, and it doesn't yet appear what we shall be, for we know that when he shall appear, we will be like him, for we will see him as he is." You know, at that time we'll see things clearly. We can't see it clearly now. And Psalm 16, that's the one I was talking about earlier, mistakenly thinking it was Psalm 34. Psalm 16 and verse 11. "You will show me the path of life, and your presence is fullness of joy. At your right hand there are pleasures forevermore." We can only guess what those pleasures are. We don't know. We don't have all the answers. But the feast and the fall, I've said that what I've already covered here, to me is analogous to Passover, the introduction, the unleavened bread, getting to know one another, getting to understand what the way of life is all about. And then Pentecost, picturing the marriage contract. What's the future hold? Well, we have the fall feast days to look forward and to think and to speculate, because some of it we just don't know. We just don't know. But what we do know is that it's going to be good. And until then, we must keep in mind the expectations that God has of us that are totally reasonable, and be loyal to our fiancé, Jesus Christ.